That's from the National Weather Service. Sunny skies today, a high of 60. Winds will be calm. Clear skies tonight, a low of 47. Then for tomorrow, Friday, sunny, a bit warmer, a high of 63. The five-day weather trend calls for dry conditions to continue, with temperatures holding in the 60s. The normal for this time of year is 68. Right now, 42, I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am very, very happy indeed that once again I can welcome into our studios Dr. Art Sear from the faculty at Carthage College to offer his thoughts and reflections on various issues and events related to our nation and our world. I'm sure many of you read on a regular basis Dr. Sear's columns that appear all across the country, including right here in the Kenosha News, also author of After the Cold War, and a monthly visitor to our morning show, and we're always so happy and honored to have him. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Well, Professor Berg, thank you so much. I come here mainly for the gracious introduction, which I really appreciate. Nowadays, I need that, believe me.
Well, really glad to have you here. It's always wonderful to talk with you. I was just telling you before we went on the air that I had the pleasure recently of doing a phone interview with a former faculty colleague of ours, William Kuhn, who used to teach at Carthage, and a published author many times over, and an expert on British royalty and British history. And we had him on, I recorded an interview the day after Queen Elizabeth's funeral. And so it was an opportunity for him to reflect not only on those dramatic events, her funeral and so on, but also on her long life and, of course, her long reign, her record-breaking reign as Britain's monarch. I guess maybe before we talk about her career and her legacy and her significance, I would be really curious to know what you watched of the events after her death, including that majestic state funeral in Westminster Abbey and the committal service that followed shortly thereafter, and what kind of impression it left you, those dramatic events at the very end of her life?
Well, I had the opportunity to watch some video, and I've read a fair amount, including the way the Financial Times, it's the British counterpart of the Wall Street Journal, and like the Journal, they cover business and financial news, what's going on in industry in depth, but they also have extensive general news, and the paper was overwhelmed by news of the Queen's passing and all the different aspects thereof, whether it was their the kind of consumer emphasis on conspicuous consumption in the magazine that they put in the Sunday edition, or the houses and country living section, which is always substantial. Whatever it was, there was coverage of the Queen, which underscored to me just how important the royal family is in Britain. I do have a clear memory long ago of seeing her coronated, the coronation of the young Queen Elizabeth. In the early 1950s, I happened to be in kindergarten, and the whole elementary school in Los Angeles, California, was adjourned to what seemed to me to be a massive auditorium. And way down, at the foot of what I guess was an ascending set of bleacher-style seats, there was a very large wooden cabinet with a rather small black and white TV screen. And we all received a fairly long, from my point of view, a fairly long lecture about the importance of Great Britain. This was not long after World War II, of course, and the importance of the Queen, and it was a major event.
Wow.
And there was a long educational dimension to it from various teachers.
I can relate to that. I wasn't alive when Queen Elizabeth was coronated, but I have a similar recollection in the late 1960s. I feel like it was 1967 or 68 that her son Charles, now King Charles, but then Prince Charles,
yes,
was crowned the Prince of Wales in a ceremony that was televised. And my understanding now since then is that was done at a time when the British family, I mean, even ahead of the more recent scandals that kind of rocked the British royalty, that was a time when apparently the sort of public opinion about the British family was, for some reason, at a bit of a low ebb, and it was thought by the royal family and their advisors that it would be good to do something high profile and on television, and so this crowning of the Prince of Wales was, in a sense, kind of concocted and televised, and similar kind of thing. We were marched into the little gym at our elementary school, and a small little TV was wheeled out onto the stage, and you know, we could barely see it, but we could see it enough to know, you know, something was happening and somebody was getting crowned. But it was interesting that those teachers and administrators in that little town in Iowa thought that this was something that we elementary students in America should be watching. It does say something about our nation's relationship to the country, to the country of Britain.
Thank you very much for mentioning that. That's certainly instructive for me. About the same time I did meet her. I never had the honor of meeting the Queen, but I did meet her husband, Prince Philip. I was in Army ROTC. I was fortunate enough to get my college education at UCLA in Los Angeles. And a really great opportunity for me. Prince Philip visited. UCLA is in the high rent district. Westwood Village is a commercial center, basically, but surrounded by Beverly Hills and Brentwood and Bel Air, and to the northwest up the coast, Pacific beachfront, there's a lot in Malibu. There's a lot of very, very expensive housing. And I was part of the Army ROTC honor guard for him. And a large auditorium, I think it was Pauley Pavilion, was pretty full, almost all women. It was an older audience, but a very large crowd from the surrounding area. He arrived in what must have been the biggest Rolls-Royce limousine I've ever seen. It was so gigantic, and I wasn't a small child by at that point, easily awed. It was so big, he stood up before he opened the door, and before the door was opened for him, and he got out.
And that's a big limousine.
And then, instead of proceeding in, he sort of diverted himself from where he was being guided, and he came over and shook hands and talked with each of the young men in uniform. He was very conservative. In fact, you might call him right-wing, and felt very strongly that the Labor government under Prime Minister Harold Wilson should really be supporting us in Vietnam, which they quite wisely, in hindsight, absolutely refused to do. But he was very gracious, a very, very, truly a very classy guy in the best sense.
Wow.
He certainly got our votes. Yeah. And not every VIP, there were Americans who, as far as they were concerned, you were part of the furniture.
Not in this case.
No.
Well, and that certainly speaks to the graciousness for which Queen Elizabeth II was even more renowned than her husband.
Yeah.
And over the course of her very, very long reign, the longest reign of any British monarch. When you wrote about Queen Elizabeth II, I thought it was interesting that what you spent the most time talking about was some of the remarkable activity in which she engaged during the Second World War. And, of course, this was at a time when she was still Princess Elizabeth, and her father was still king. So, first of all, before you kind of spell out the specifics of what you talked about, which is quite fascinating, I'm just wondering why you found yourself drawn to that in terms of kind of at least the initial focus of your written tribute to her.
I'm writing mainly, not exclusively, I'm proud to say, but mainly for an American audience. The Anglo-American special relationship really was forged during World War II. We were allies during World War I. Particularly interesting to me that our intelligence services, British intelligence, and American counterparts, the OSS and then CIA, didn't emerge really till the Second War. But during the total war of the Second World War, we really became close allies and friends, and her participation in that war is important. I believe the class system didn't end, but was drastically changed by the Second World War, when the British, like the Americans and others, were fully mobilized in this total war, which we could have lost and were losing for a while, and the British really played a pivotal role during 40-41 after the fall of France and before Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. During that time, it was very important. Also, the royal family plays an extremely important symbolic role. I believe she was about 13 when the European War started in 39, and she made radio broadcasts to the children of Britain, which, given the role of the royal family, really encouraged national unity. The role of the crown is extraordinarily important, and King George VI, thank God, proved to be a ready partner of Winston Churchill's and the wartime government, and they were really partners. They'd go around together and bombed out areas of London, but also other parts of the nation. Anyway, as a young child, she influenced parents as well, emphasizing in these broadcasts, quite articulate, and I'm confident she didn't write the script at that point, but a really shrewd, clever move by our very shrewd, good friends across the Atlantic. And then she became a truck driver, which was her idea when she was a couple of years older and was part of the Women's Army Corps. And she wasn't just a propaganda figure. No, she was actually a mechanic and driver. Before power steering, it was very, very literally, physically extraordinarily hard work, also dangerous. The Germans were still bombing. And then during the last year of the war, they invented ballistic missiles and early drones. And these V-1s and V-2s were devastating parts of London and other parts of Britain. So she really risked her life in a very courageous way that should inspire everyone.
Wow. I knew a little bit about what she had done in the Second World War, although you certainly expanded my understanding of
that.
Well,
thank you.
I had not heard that it was her idea.
Yeah,
and that makes it even that makes it even more intriguing that she would make bold choices like that even at that young age, when another choice could have been to have her placed in as much as was possible out of harm's way, and it sounds like that was not what she was interested in.
Yes, no, that would have been a very bad idea. I'd be surprised if they did that, but George VI and the Queen Mother did not want her out driving a truck.
Right, I'm sure.
But went along with it.
Yeah. Well, and you're right, that's had to have an enormous impact on the British public at the time, and certainly had some resonance even with us way over here in America, I should think, at that point in time. When you go on to write about Elizabeth as Queen, at one point you say Queen Elizabeth played her unusually complicated role with dignified skill. Explain how her role was unusually complicated. What was complicated about being queen?
Our British friends really love ceremonies. Everybody does at some level, but even us egalitarian Americans. But and they've really perfected them over the last 1,000 years or so. But the monarch is the head of state as opposed to the head of government, and there is residual political power, and they play a role in terms of personifying the emotional aspects of government. I believe the column you have the advantage of generally reading these well after I've written them.
Right.
And I was kind of scrambling around last night to get current work done. Walter Badgett, B like Bravo, A-G-E-H-O-T, longtime editor of The Economist, a very publication I recommend to everybody, weekly that started out focusing on the economy and business during the Victorian age, but covers everything, including the USA, and is really educational. Anyway, he wrote a book called The English Constitution back, I think, in the 1860s, and he brilliantly analyzed dignified and efficient functions of government. And he felt the genius of the British system, and I agree, and we're not alone, is that they separate the dignified functions, the business of government, politicians who come and go, and they're there to do a job for the people and the nation. And the prime minister is not a figure who develops a great emotional following unless for some reason he or she, they've now had three women prime ministers, we got to catch up. Tony Blair is now a widely hated figure because of the Iraq War, in which the British were loyal partners of the George W. Bush administration. But except for special circumstances, they're kind of employees of the people who do a job. The great emotion of politics is focused on the monarchy, and that's where people really develop a sense of family loyalty. There is a reason why it tends to be female audiences in this country. When the monarch visits. It's really a brilliant insight, and in this country we don't have that distinction. I believe he referred to that. The Kennedys became very popular, in a way, during the brief Kennedy administration because they brilliantly, President Kennedy and even more his wife, fulfilled these highly emotional aspects of government. They were made to order, and he barely won in 60, I think, in part because of that dimension, after the profoundly successful, we now realize, but extremely monotonous two terms of the Eisenhowers. Nothing went wrong. I mean, certainly, it was truly brilliant leadership. Eisenhower worked like a dog, as we now know, extraordinarily effective in using. But people were a bit bored.
There was nothing sexy about the Eisenhower administration.
That's it. You said it. Yes, sexy. Thank you for bringing up that word, young man. So I can actually talk that way. Absolutely. And the Kennedys were everywhere.
Right.
Even before the 1960 election, Joseph Kennedy, the field marshal of that very successful, for a while, family enterprise, was very, very conscious of and very, very brilliant at using the media. I can go on about that. I hope that point is clear, dignified, and efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. And points to one of my favorite lines in the column where you say, today the Queen and Parliament have subtly complementary roles. I think that's part of what you're getting
at. Yes, I think that was where. Thank you for quoting me. I like that.
So we now have, or the British, I should say, have on the throne Queen Elizabeth's oldest son, Charles. So now we have King Charles. And what is your sense of what kind of challenges lay ahead for him and kind of the current state of the monarchy as far as the general British public is concerned?
He's an eccentric figure and has been from a very young age. He, unlike his mother, he immerses himself in controversial issues. There are people who believe that she did not gracefully retire in favor of her son because of his unusual personality and quirks. He's something of a figure of fun, to put it politely, to the British. More bluntly, he seems like something out of Monty Python, it's almost a satirical figure. The environment is, he's very extreme in his views on the subject. Good-hearted, this is not, in any way a self-serving set of beliefs, but even the Conservative Party, which is much less aristocratic and much more business-oriented than it used to be, the Conservative Party, the pro-monarchy party, for the last few hundred years at least, they will refer to him publicly in a rather sneering way. which struck me, going back to the 90s at least. And so King Charles III now, I believe, he's got his work cut out for him.
Yeah.
Hope he makes it.
Right. I have to say, I was very impressed with the quality and eloquence of his televised remarks after his mother's death. I mean,
yes.
I was really impressed with how those words were put together. Again, it's presumably not something that he wrote on his own, for sure. But the way he spoke about her, and also the way he touched on the kind of estrangement between William and Henry, and Harry, I should say, and Harry's choice to kind of remove himself from active royal life, that was talked about in a way that seemed honest and authentic, and to say nothing of eloquent. And I was really impressed, more than I expected to be. And, of course, being king is a lot more than just giving speeches. But at least as far as that's concerned, he strikes me as effective.
Good for him and good for you. You're very good-hearted. I really mean that.
We'll see that. Well,
and he may well rise to the occasion. George, there's a great film, or so into, I'm not, but the rest of the population seems to be, into films, The King's Speech.
Oh, yeah.
About how George VI, a very, very, very decent man, a really impressive man personally, very, very painfully shy, how he had a serious speech impediment which he was able to overcome. It's really a brilliant film.
I agree.
Tremendous production values, but it's also relatively accurate.
Mm.
And the war really, actually, no one's defending war, but like Churchill, he really was... proved to be made to order for the war.
Absolutely.
And that helped him as a man, as well as a leader, really assert himself.
Right. And just to clarify for our listeners, we're talking about Queen Elizabeth's father, who is the figure
yes.
in this film, and who did struggle mightily and for the most part successfully to overcome this really serious speech impediment. That and of course, you know, this man who was not supposed to be king and yet became king when his brother abdicated, suddenly found himself in this harsh spotlight that he had not expected, perhaps not even wanted. And that film tells that story beautifully.
The brother who stepped down, Edward VIII, he was around and a very public figure throughout a good part of my life, along with Wallace Simpson, the American expatriate whom he married. They were always in movie magazines and gossip columns. And she had been divorced twice, and she wasn't American, and that became a big controversial issue. But the real reason the political leadership wanted to get rid of him was he was pro-Nazi.
Mm.
And Adolf Hitler and his associates in Berlin actually had fairly detailed plans. To always working on detailed plans right up until the end. It shows you can't just do plans.
Right.
And you make sure you're facing reality as well.
Right.
But they were going to use him to control Britain after they controlled the entire continent throughout most of the war. And for a year, they were really in charge, and the British were fighting alone. When they finally invaded the islands and took over, they were going to use him. He was, in fact, a very dangerous man.
Mm.
And after he stepped down, the British were quite effective. None of this was really in the news, but they were desperate, including Churchill, who was a monarchist and his original defender. He was quite eccentric, I believe was probably clinically insane. But he loved to go to Hollywood, but he really loved those chaps, those wonderful fellows in Berlin.
Hmm.
It's scary
wow.
when you look into the details. And Churchill sent him to, I think, Bermuda.
Right.
Maybe Jamaica. He wanted to get him as far away, nowhere near Spain, where he liked to go to make contact with his good German buddies.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
It is really scary to think how the tide of history could have turned in some really, really dangerous ways if... things had just played out a little bit differently.
Well, people do make a difference, don't they? Individually as leaders, but also collectively.
As did Queen Elizabeth.
You can't be a leader unless you can. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
And the royal family was really quite, after they finally unloaded the goofy and very very risky relative. They really did a heroic job, as did the British people as a whole.
Right. And one certainly has a sense that that helped really cement for Elizabeth throughout her long reign that overwhelming sense of duty and responsibility with which she dispatched her reign as queen. 70 years.
Yes, I believe she met and made a point of meeting every president, starting with FDR, certainly with Truman. FDR had the royal family in the midst of our isolationism and commitment to staying out of the war before Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt very shrewdly had the royal family coming over at a very crucial time, I believe in the summer of 41, and made sure there was tremendous and very positive media attention to them. The darkest hour, since we're talking about, we're going Hollywood this morning, I'm sure it's good for me. Darkest Hour is another great film. For Hollywood, it's not only fine drama, I believe, but also pretty well captures the desperate atmosphere of that time. And Churchill's rise from being a political pariah, that's no exaggeration, to being somebody who became centrally important.
Changed everything.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Art Sear from the faculty at Carthage College. He is a monthly visitor to the morning show, and it's always great to have him here. Professor Sear, your most recent column, which I think not a lot of people will have even had a chance to see yet, concerns what you describe as enormous mass public demonstrations in the nation of Iran. And you say that these demonstrations are something that probably should have fundamentalist Islamic rulers there very, very concerned. So describe to our listeners who perhaps have not heard very much about this yet the nature of these demonstrations and what has touched them off.
22, well, thank you for mentioning the column. It'll be in tomorrow's Racine Journal Time and Kenosha News. And you can read it online, but please let's all try to keep traditional newspapers alive. So our timing is very good.
Yeah.
And you read it first. The regime, some really kind of stupid cops arrested their political police. Not a joking matter. A 22-year-old young woman was arrested because she, and put in jail, because she was actually wearing the headdress that is dictated for all females in Iran to wear, but she wasn't wearing it quite right. And we were discussing dictatorship and the many vices and criminal tendencies thereof, and she died in jail. And the authorities initially ignored the matter, and then tremendous public demonstrations have exploded across Iran, in cities, everywhere throughout that quite large country, actually. And they are continuing, and they may bring down the regime in protest against this terrible criminal act.
So it's, as you talk about this new turbulence in Iran, you also say at one point, Iran continues to be a focus of frustration for U.S. foreign policy. What has been kind of the sticking point there?
The sticking point has been great mutual hostility since 1979, when a pro-Western, long-established regime, also a dictatorship,
the Shah,
the Shah of Iran, a very secular leader with all the trappings of monarchy for himself and his family, the Shah of Iran, long-established, supported by American and British intelligence. They were crucial in putting him in power after Mossadegh was overthrown. During the Cold War, it was not a hot war, it wasn't World War II, but it was a very serious ideological and political and military struggle with the Soviet Union and their many allies and supporters. They're a strategically crucial nation. An Islamic revolt overthrew the regime. It collapsed very quickly. Speaking of strong leaders, he definitely was not. The family came to the United States. Islamic fundamentalists took over the U.S. embassy and held a large part of the diplomatic staff hostage for many months. things deteriorated from there, and we have been in a position in a situation of considerable hostility between the two countries since 1979. I believe the Shah's father, a powerful figure in that environment generally, was thought to have been involved in murdering the Ayatollah Khomeini's father. So it was very much a blood feud.
Wow.
In what is already a fiery and explosive part of the world, referring to the emotional dimensions of politics.
Right.
So it's been a real problem for the United States. Hmm. I've been recommending reading Richard Nixon's book. He wrote a number of books, starting with Six Crises, after he left the vice presidency and then was defeated for governor of California in 1962. Nixon, after he was forced from the presidency, wrote a whole series of books that are really great guides, legal briefs, I describe them, for foreign policy. And the book, I think, The Real War, one of about a half a dozen that are quite worthwhile, he, with his usual foresight, said, Iraq is a very irritating regime. It's a very annoying regime. It's also essentially a stable regime. Saddam Hussein is a very, very ugly and aggressive figure. He's very unattractive, but he represents no real security threat to us. If we invade and overthrow Iraq's leader and regime, which is regularly trumpeted in this country, we'll do nothing but strengthen in tremendous ways our real power rival in the region, which is Iran. Mm. Nixon published that in the early 90s, about a decade before the George W. Bush administration. Not only unwisely, but very stupidly, from my point of view, did exactly that. They invaded and overthrew Iraq, and ever since it's been a rat's nest for extremism, an endless drain, and money as well as blood for lots of nations, including our country.
Right. And it has likewise then put Iran in an even stronger position in the region.
Quite right.
Yeah.
However, they really are distinctive. The Shah was a great modernizer. There is a very large middle class. Before 79, it was a relatively prosperous country in terms of the average person compared to other Arab states, other OPEC states, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. There is a very large professional population, including a large female professional population. It's not the standard kind of environment where Islamic fundamentalists are in charge. It's light years away from Afghanistan, say. And it's meant that I wish we had been more flexible early on in cultivating more directly the population of Iran. But I'm a professor on the sidelines. It's easy to talk about these things that you might do. But I think at long last, the population may be rising up against this dictatorship. It is not a passive population at all. And there's a very large, especially female, well-educated, very sophisticated part of the population. The terrible death, probably murder, I believe, of this innocent young woman in custody is the catalyst for what may well bring down the regime.
Wow.
I hope it does, because the alternative may not be a democracy at this point, but whatever comes in, I believe, will be better for the Iranian people. Hmm. I think if Putin goes down, for example, things might well get even worse in Russia. Hmm. But it doesn't seem like that would be the case in Iran.
Interesting.
Yeah.
At one point you say in that column, dictators can no longer completely suppress information, though Tehran is trying. And so, you know, that's also, you know, it's a kind of a different game now in this world where people walk around with cell phones that they can capture images and transmit them, you know, essentially around the globe at an instant.
No, today it happens constantly.
Right.
20th century totalitarianism cannot be continued, even in North Korea, places like North Korea or Myanmar, which is essentially an ugly and very repressive regime. You just can't do that anymore. There were in 2009, there were very, very large demonstrations because a lot of Iranian citizens, they do have elections. not free in any way in our sense, but they do have elections and competition, and there's a lot of competition among these ayatollahs, these mullahs. There is not just one dictator in charge in Iran. It's a whole bunch of rather rigid and zealous fundamentalist religious types who often disagree with each other. In 2009, there were protests against a corrupt election, and they did not become as extensive as these. But people with cell phones, especially sophisticated women with cell phones, were very, very active in that protest, which the government, which eventually dissipated, and the government was able to suppress without really draconian measures.
Wow.
Yeah, they're trying to jam social media and the internet now with some success, but you just can't completely shut off a population the way Adolf Hitler and associates literally shut off the German people.
Right.
Who thought they were winning until nearly the end.
It reminds me of an interview that will air on Monday. It's a story out of Syria, actually, from some years ago when a young boy named Muhammad Najem captured remarkable images and interviews with other children to try to tell that story of what it was like to be a child in war-torn Syria. They did not have a lot of wide circulation until a reporter from CNN just happened upon it. And the next thing you know, CNN is actually sharing some of the dispatches of this young boy. Well, he was, I think, 14 or 15 at the time. And anyway, a new book. She has written a new book about him called Muhammad Najem, War Reporter, which tells the story of this courageous young teenage boy in Syria. And but it speaks to the same thing, that whatever was going on in Syria, anybody courageous enough to step out on the street with their cell phone and capture images could share that story. And he did.
That's an extremely important as well as interesting interview. I hope as many people as possible will listen to that program. Syria is another very important regional player, one of Russia's few allies. They provide Russia with a long warm water port and trade access that is historically extremely important to Russia, to the Soviet Union. They are essentially a very stable regime. They are not our enemy. They were an ally in the Gulf War. We constantly complain about them, but it's an area that provides real importance strategically.
Interesting.
And they are a they have, in my opinion, been a factor for stability that's very much in our interest in that region. But this interview is extremely important, whether or not, whatever my opinion might be. I hope congratulations on getting that interview. That is really important.
So that airs on Monday. Let's finish out by talking, we actually will have to touch fairly briefly, but nevertheless, let's touch on Ukraine and also on North Korea. You've written about both of those situations. Regarding North Korea, you write about North Korea turning down an interesting offer that had come from the leader of South Korea, sort of a trade economic aid for nuclear disarmament. And the fact that North Korea turned down that offer is not a huge surprise, but the way in which that offer was turned down and maybe by whom, that's kind of, in a sense, as big a part of the story as anything. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, the current, quote, great leader, unquote, along with about 12 or 15 other titles of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, he normally appears in public for these extreme, very hostile statements about whatever is on the table at the moment. This time his sister who was also a very senior party and government official. It's kind of a medieval clan or gang that's in charge of North Korea. She appeared, which greatly fueled persistent rumors about him, as about Putin, that he actually is extremely sick. He popped up to reject the most recent aid offer that was proffered by what is a rather conservative and hard-line regime in South Korea. And it's one more instance of the North Korea government very short-sightedly rejecting olive branches from South Korea or from the U.S. It underscores the weakness, essentially, of North Korea. And Kim Jong-un apparently is still at least at the top. Although, as with Iran, I believe they've been wildly erratic in their declarations and their policies over time. There has been some movement. There were, I believe, East Asia Games a few years ago now in northern South Korea, and a North Korean delegation did come down. In terms of family reunification, the North Koreans have been somewhat more flexible in recent times. But it also symbolizes, and this was the main point of the column, the dramatic contrast between a failed state, essentially, in North Korea, a totalitarian dictatorship, to be sure, but a desperate regime where the people are suffering tremendously and there is no real economic growth, even though North Korea is much richer than South Korea in natural resources, and the phenomenal success story in terms of democracy as well as economic development in South Korea. Into the 1960s, South Korea was one of the poorest nations on earth, down below Burma, a peasant society. They were not Japan or any other nation that had had an industrial revolution early. And the Korean War, which went on for 3 years and was a lot like World War II, not, in contrast to the Vietnam War, it was constant combat across the peninsula, totally devastated already what was already a poor country. But they're now among the top dozen economies in the world and increasingly influential politically as well as economically, especially in high-tech industries. They've got a phenomenally effective military. The ROK Army, the Republic of Korea's, South Korea's army, is one of the most extraordinary military organizations in the world and an extraordinarily close ally of the United States. So there's a lot to be very happy about regarding the Korean Peninsula. During the Vietnam War, the South Koreans maintained 50,000 troops in South Vietnam. There was no practical reason for them to be there. Park Chung-hee and his clan, the dictators of South Korea at that time, they made a lot of money from the U.S. during the war. But that's not why the average South Korean fought so hard. They're just intensely committed to this country. So Americans should feel good about that.
Yeah. And you also call for in that column that we that as we deal with, for instance, North Korea, we think about it in terms of coordination with other nations and think about it, you know, in terms of the overall region and who the players are there.
Yes, and I believe the Obama and the Biden administrations have done that. There's been a tremendous steady expansion of military as well as economic cooperation among the nations. RIMPAC, which is rarely mentioned, RIMPAC, the Rim of the Pacific military exercises are becoming much more substantial, much more large scale, and much more collaborative, involving a wide range of nations, including, I think, South American nations, as well as North American nations, a good deterrent for not only North Korea, but also China, and a great way for South Korea and Japan, historically nations with a bitter and unpleasant heritage, to become more collaborative with one another.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To finish out, one of your recent columns talks about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, which, of course, has not played out at all the way Mr. Putin had planned. You call it a case of very serious miscalculation on Putin's part. One of the things you say is that the greatest lesson so far in the war with Ukraine is the unpredictability of war, a durable truth frequently ignored. And probably Mr. Putin's not the only person who tends to ignore that truth, but it's probably something that leaders everywhere should be keeping in mind. What is the nature of the unpredictability that you're talking about in this particular conflict?
Well, war is not only a terrible phenomenon, but as the Ukrainian fighting men are demonstrating, the will, morale, the human dimension remains very crucial, something that Dwight Eisenhower and George S. Patton Jr., the World War II Patton in that long military family, they would regularly refer to the fact, I'd like to say, that any damn fool can start a war. The toughest challenge for any national leader is to end a war on terms that make sense and are helpful to your people and, if possible, the world at large. But the toughest job is to avoid a war completely if you can do so. Worth thinking about and very important. And Patton, a very troubled man who was brilliant in war, and like General Sherman, he had difficulty when there wasn't. He was really fulfilled in combat and had difficulty with normal life. He actually felt the same way, at least when he was calm, that war is a very, very unpredictable, and the best environment is no war.
Hmm. Your column goes on to...
It's the most human of... business can be rough, and the marketplace is unforgiving, but you're not usually dealing with life and death. At least you shouldn't be.
Right.
And any human activity is more predictable, collective activity, than war itself.
Right.
That's the main point. Also, technology.
Right. I was just going to say, you go into the development of weaponry and how that changed the very nature of warfare, and in some ways really profoundly changed that whole business of its unpredictability.
Precision, long-range firepower, artillery, but especially rifles, starting in our Civil War, and then the development of the machine gun, which was present in prototype form during the Civil War, but not widely used. That really favored the defense. The last year of the American Civil War, especially on the Eastern Front, was very much trench warfare that was a precursor to the First World War. The development of enormously powerful mobile weaponry, the tank, tactical aircraft, strategic aircraft, even more accurate firepower that was machine-based, not just on the tank, made war much more mobile. Interestingly, Eisenhower went out of his way to befriend Patton, two very different men temperamentally. They became actually very good friends and both published articles on the importance of the tank back in the 1920s when the U.S. Army was still emphasizing horses.
Hmm.
And tanks were some kind of contraption, like battleship admirals and the aircraft carrier. Combined arms, which the Germans developed to the highest state-of-the-art ground mechanized ground weapons and air power combined, were devastating in war and crucial to the mobility of ground combat in World War II. In Europe and North Africa, technology development is favoring the offense in the air today. I'm sure that will change, but everywhere else on the land, it seems to be favoring the defense.
Hmm. And of course, we're talking about Ukraine defending itself from Russia.
Yes, anti-tank weapons, Stinger missiles, which are remarkably inexpensive by today's standards. You can bring down helicopters, aircraft, including high-flying aircraft. Anti-tank weapons, precision-guided munitions have become crucial, and depending on the context, they can favor the defense. They've been extremely important, along with the terrible state of the Russian army, we've learned.
Hmm.
They're extremely important in favoring even a smaller force. And that's a development of the 70s. The Than Hoa Bridge in North Vietnam over the Song Ma River was a target of the U.S. military from 1965 in Vietnam, main strategic artery into South Vietnam. There were hundreds of sorties to destroy it. I've never been there. I've seen pictures. I've never really seen pictures of it. But it was very hard to hit, the way it was positioned geographically, maybe in a gorge. But finally, in 1972, the U.S. Air Force did knock it out using precision.